So it's a pleasure to be here this morning. Welcome. I am responsible for tanning, so I take it none of you is at risk. Looking around the room, clearly I don't have to worry about giving the tanning public health message here, for better or worse, actually. I do have relationships to disclose. I'm actually, Joel Kaufman and I were in the American Medical Student Association as Joel preceded me as the chair of the occupational component of the American Medical Student Association in 1999. Was a very good year, and Joel would kill me if I actually revealed the year. But this is just to let you know, I do have a relationship to disclose. So, but there's no commercial transaction there. So what I was asked to talk about has, if you looked at the title of all of the presentations, it was an exercise in which one of these is different than the others. There's no content in this presentation at all. Just so we're clear on that, none whatsoever. But I do hope to, my mother has pointed out to me, she is an executive in Massachusetts, and my dad, who also does public health in Massachusetts, still going into work every day at the Massachusetts State Public Health Laboratory. So aside from the fact that I was genetically condemned to be in this position, my mother has instructed me from long years of public speaking that you should say at least one thing that's funny during your talk. I'm going to violate that rule, just so you're clear on that. And one thing that outrages or challenges the audience, and so that'll be coming shortly. What I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about workforce capacity. Now, you could ask, what the heck does workforce capacity have to do with translating research into action, and particularly with air pollution? The answer to the second question is it has nothing to do with air pollution. It has everything to do with research into action. And air pollution is just one of the entire breadth of workforce issues that challenges environmental health today. And I have just finished a couple of years as chair of the State Environmental Health Directors. And what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about workforce capacity, because following on the heels of what was a very, very interesting talk on GIS, and I spent a lot of time in the GIS world as the PI for Maryland's Environmental Public Health Tracking Project, what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about the total or almost total disconnect between what we're training people for in academic public health and what exists in practical public health at the state level. And if there are any people from any institutions of higher learning or the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences, for example, I'm sure they will take this message to heart, because I think it reflects, and I do absolutely think, that we have major problems with the way we've structured education related to public health in this country, even now, and even with what the Council for Environment for the Accreditation of Public Health has done, I think it's inadequate and really sort of misses the dichotomy between academic preparation and real-world workforce preparation. So, as I said, this is a lie. I did have some relationships. I disclosed them. So let me talk a little bit about environmental public health workforce as it relates to air pollution, nominally keeping us in the same part of the room. So if you look at what the folks in local public health or state public health, and it depends state to state, there are very different models of public health across the country. As it relates to air pollution, you have people who are engaged in monitoring and analysis. So now, Jesse's talk, you saw 150 monitors in how many square miles? Come on, this is a GIS question. It's 50 square miles. There is no place on the face of the planet, and there's no place in America where that data can be reproduced. None. Zero, not a single place. Los Angeles, it's possible that they've got a little bit more monitoring going on, but there are more monitors there. If you looked at North Dakota and look for how much air monitoring data there are, you'll find a couple of monitors maybe. And there are great swaths of the rest of the country. In Maryland, which is a pretty urbanized state, pretty populated, about the same population as Massachusetts, you look at the eastern shore and the western part of the state, there is no real-time air monitoring data for either parts of those states. And Maryland is not the exception, it's the rule. It's actually better monitored in the I-95 corridor than most of the rest of the country is. So what you saw from Jesse is a wonderful example of the value of data that are totally unobtainable anywhere else in the country. And who does those data? Who collects those data? Well, NASA can collect those data sort of because there are some remote sensing technologies that you can, using LIDAR or various other techniques, infer what the concentration of PM2.5 might be. But for real-time data, you actually need people who can go out and collect these data, check the monitors, collect the filter papers, and run the analyses. And these analyses are run, for example, for particulates in state public health laboratories, many of them, many of which are cutting back on these monitoring programs because of insufficient funding. So there are people who go out and do environmental monitoring and analysis. That's everything from actually collecting the samples, servicing the monitors, to taking the samples physically, bringing them in, and running them in the laboratory. And the laboratory component of this is very, very important. Then there are the health outcomes, and there's the collection of health outcomes data. So if you looked at some of the data related to health outcomes, in New York, it's one of the densest populated places in the country, so you can actually look at neighborhood-level data. Again, if you were to look at the criteria for privacy and confidentiality, North Dakota, South Dakota, together, you can't get enough population to be able to exceed cell sizes for reporting of some of these data. And in terms of collecting the data, there's a whole workforce associated with actually doing surveillance. And in the states right now, those surveillance programs right now are under tremendous threat. So for example, all of the asthma programs that are funded by CDC are in significant jeopardy because of congressional funding cutbacks. For program development, in the states there are, and in the local health departments, there are people who talk about sort of the next phase of what Jesse's talk was, which is how you implement whatever it is that you're doing. And the people, the skill sets that are there are everything from the nuts and bolts of putting together programs together to program evaluation, et cetera. And then there's a very important component of this, which is the regulatory aspect. So there's a good chunk of my group that is involved in food that does enforcement. These are, in the old days, they were called sanitarians. They're still called sanitarians. They're very proud of those names. We've been working to try to move them into sort of the registered environmental health specialist category because one of the disconnects right now is, for those of you who are in schools of public health now or have just recently emerged, is that the right word? Cocoon-like from schools of public health. If someone had said to you, I would like to interest you in a career in being a sanitarian, doesn't really resonate. And so, we have schools which have environmental health requirements, and yet for those people who have taken courses of public health, so just a poll, for those of you who either teach public health, environmental health, or who have just taken a course within the past, say 5 years, let's just put a boundary on it, how many of you in your course of public health had a discussion of where you place the septic field in relationship to the well? Okay, all right. How many of you, okay, so we'll just take that as an example. I won't go on. But the point is, I'm assuming looking around, many more of you are within that five-year window of having emerged from a school of public health, clearly.
or being faculty members. But the point is, academic environmental health, it's about climate change, it's about toxicology, it's about genomics, it's about molecular dosimetry. Septic fields, really, not really what people talk about in environmental health often. And yet, for my folks who are out in local health departments, 50 to 60% of their time is spent on water, specifically approving subdivisions with water hookups, looking at whether the septic fields percolate or not, looking at soil types, whether or not the soil type matches. And there's a huge bunch of science that has looking at hydrologic fracking, for example, hydrofracking as an example. If we're not able and if schools are not equipped to teach those things, we're going to have an environmental health workforce that understands nothing at all of the practical applications of environmental health at the local and state level. So, I've talked a little bit about the environmental public health infrastructure, but to tell you that it is under threat is really sort of an understatement. You know about the budgetary stuff. So the budgetary stuff at the local and state level is significant. What's even more significant is that threats in the federal budgets, right now, probably on average, most departments of public health at the local and state level, 40-45% of their positions are actually federal positions. They're federally funded, either completely or partially. So what's happening as a result of budget cutbacks at the federal level is that it's having a ripple effect in state health departments and local health departments. There's also a huge issue with technical capacity. We have a lot of people who have 20, 30 years of experience who were trained in an area where they did talk about wells, septic systems, and other things. Now you have the people coming in who are junior, who really don't have much exposure to those practical real-world applications, who need to be trained on the job. The problem is that they can't be hired unless they're able to pass registration exams, for which they must have that training already. So we're training them, essentially retraining them, or in some cases completely training them, in local health departments, but there's a time limit that we have imposed before which they have to pass the exam, or by which they have to pass the exam, otherwise we can't retain them. So we have a huge problem here. What happened? Let me just show you a little bit what it is that we do. Because I don't do any of this. But this is the scope of what people are doing in public health. Everything from lead to radiation, chemical emergencies, food and water. Food and water probably comprise about 50% of the basic underlying work of environmental public health. Asthma surveillance, natural disasters, healthy housing, indoor air quality, healthy communities. So if you look at what it is that we're teaching people and what it is that they're doing, I've already mentioned that disconnect. The challenge, I think, is as the workforce shrinks and capacity shrinks, we need to think about public health education and schools of public health as completely different than they are operating right now. I think, in reality, we actually ought to be thinking about a hybrid model that looks more like a combination of academic preparation and apprenticeship. And in fact, capstone projects are sending people in for a couple of weeks to a public health department is a useless exercise. And I say this is the outrage part of the talk. I think it's not a very good use of either the student's time or, frankly, the health department's time. What I think is more useful is think about a model where, for example, in postdoctoral training programs for laboratorians who are funded by the National Institute for Environmental Health Science in schools of public health, think about having them spend a year in a public health laboratory funded by NIEHS. It helps to address some of the workplace workforce shortage. It also gives them grounding in actual real-world public health, and it makes up for the fact that in many times they may be very good with LC-MS-MS in a laboratory in the School of Public Health and with genomics,
But if they have to learn about the handling of specimens, forensic specimens related to food or other kinds of substances for federal regulatory programs, it gives them an introduction to something that they never will be exposed to in their academic setting. Similarly, with epidemiologists, the idea of spending less than 3 to 5 months, usually, and 6 months probably makes more sense, in a real-world situation is probably more valuable for them, and you could think about a school of public health doing a different model than the model of coursework plus 2 hours spent in a health department every couple of weeks, which for me, I mean, it's nice to be able to spend time with students that way, but it's not really very useful for them in many respects. And it's not really addressing the workforce shortage as it pertains to the departments. So I think what we really need to be doing is looking at a different model of education for schools of public health. Second, I think we need to look at much more than we are at information technology and informatics. People have to have more training in informatics than they have right now. And that's everybody, the exception is probably the epidemiologists who get a fair amount of informatics now, but the environmental health workforce gets a totally inadequate amount of time in informatics, needs much more, has to have much more, and that's the practitioners. It's not creating a separate cadre of informatics people. It's taking people who are our practitioners in environmental health and giving them training in informatics. And then finally, for environmental health, this is a passion of mine, which is getting kids in primary and secondary schools understanding through the simple experiment what environmental public health is. And the simple experiment is this, and I stole this, by the way, from Jerry Paulson, who is a physician and environmental health specialist at Children's Environmental Health in Washington. Okay, so here's the experiment. Ready? Everybody close your eyes. Okay, now think of the environment. God, I love a compliant group. You've all been in school way too long. Open your eyes. Okay, show of hands, how many people saw a person? Look around the room. Liam, that's not fair. You've seen me done this before. Liar. I knew. Okay, say two people in the audience saw a person. That is the conundrum of environmental public health. If you can do that with middle schoolers and with high school students, that's the beginning of getting people to understand that what Jesse is talking about in terms of air pollution and its impacts on people is not clean air. It's what are the public health consequences of dirty air. And you have to get people to begin to see people in the picture when they close their eyes. So that's, for better or for worse, this is the budget stuff. I've already talked about this. Everybody's having budget cuts. And so I've already talked a little bit about this, and this is sort of the take-home message, is I think this is a responsibility that we all share. Schools of public health agencies, the funding agencies, critically, and this includes Pew, Robert Wood Johnson, NIEHS, NIH, et cetera, we have to start thinking differently about the models that we use in order to train people. Because unless we do that, what you're going to find is that we're training people for careers that don't exist in the public health agencies, and we're doing a disservice to the current students right now. So I'll stop there.
Thank you very much.